What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. What do you do when you see a problem in your organization? Do you wait for someone else to notice and solve it? Do you complain to your coworkers about it or even play the victim, explaining why you could never fix it? Or maybe you are a doer and take action to solve the problem? On the show to help you become a doer are Karen Holst and Douglas Ferguson, the co-authors of Start Within, How to Sell Your Idea, Overcome Roadblocks, and Love Your Job. In this conversation, we dive into what it takes to solve problems and bring ideas to life in your organization. Karen and Douglas discuss why they wrote the book, how it's different, the importance of being disciplined as a way to move forward, the power of provocative questions, what a prototype is and what it is not, and why seeking feedback is a superpower. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/429. Karen and Douglas, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It's wonderful to talk with you both today.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's great.
So I love to ask this question of everyone that I interview when I start out, and it's simply, what are you endlessly curious about? And I'll go ahead and start with you, Karen.
At my core, I love to solve problems. Like I wake up from a bad dream getting chased and I want to go back to sleep so I can try to solve it before I wake up again. It is a compulsion and something that I find very, you know, valuable in my work. But it's also made me very curious about how other people go about solving their problems and the processes that they go through and the frameworks and mindsets that they adopt. So I'm always trying to learn from others and how they go about solving problems.
Wow. That's awesome. Douglas, what about you?
You know, this is a tough question for me because I think of myself as a lifelong learner. Mm-hmm. And I think, so maybe the answer is everything. And it changes a lot. Like in any moment that I'm pulling on a thread of something and you know, of course I've got stacks of books and my wife always gives me grief about, you're not reading half of those. I saw an article not that long ago that said, you know, stacks of books are a good thing because it keeps you humble because it reminds you of all the things you don't know. So I guess I'm just curious about life and everything there is to offer out there.
I can relate to that so much. And I have, not only do I have stacks of books, but I use business cards as my bookmarks. And on some shelves, you can just see a line of bookmarks. It's like that's very humbling. It's like I've started and I have proof that I've started and not finished. So if we could just start with a short background of who you are and what you do, just so that we can kind of get an understanding of the journey to where you are today.
I started out as an entrepreneur, co-founding an educational technology startup. Mm-hmm. And after we got acquired, had this moment of really wanting to find the next challenge, but not necessarily wanting to be a founder again, at least in the near future. So I had the opportunity to join a year-long fellowship with the California Department of Education, where they were taking private sector leaders and putting them into public sector problems. And that really opened my eyes to what entrepreneurship is about, the challenges and the similarities to entrepreneurship. And it just kind of change my world purview that I don't need to have the idea of, you know, the business to be able to go after ideas and solve problems within a bigger organization. So from that point, I joined IDEO in helping them launch products and services, and later did projects with Autodesk and other companies. And currently I'm teaching on innovation and how to launch products, how to, you know, start within.
I started my career writing software in the late 90s, and that led to leadership positions, mostly holding CTO roles where I oversaw engineering and product, and was always really fascinated by this kind of trifecta of, you know, technology, market and design. And if we can balance those things, we can create really compelling products. And, you know, there's been folks that have come along that have articulated some of those things and inspired me. And through that journey, also really fascinated by how to get teams working better together and moving past like obstacles and roadblocks. And fast forward to now, I'm running a what I call a facilitation agency. We're a group of facilitators or coaches that come in and help teams work better together. And we're on a mission to rid the world of horrible meetings.
I imagine, given where we're at in today's society with, you know, working from home, the bad meeting has morphed in unbelievable ways.
Yeah. And, you know, now people have the ability just to say, oh, my connection died, and they can skip out on the horrible meeting. But, you know, there was a reason why that horrible meeting was created. And if we can be more in service of that purpose, then we can get the work done. And, you know, I think there's a lot of great tips and start within that that align with this way of thinking as well.
Excellent. So we're here to talk about the book that you both wrote together, Start Within, How to Sell Your Idea, Overcome Roadblocks, and Love Your Job. And the first thing that I got curious about reading this is, how did the two of you find each other and work together and write this book together?
Before I started my podcast, I had a interview series that I did where I was interviewing innovation leaders. So these are people that were either academics or consultants or even in-house folks that were doing really awesome stuff. And what I wanted to do was to stitch together these stories to look at what works in one area and what doesn't work in that area, and kind of share stories across these different domains and disciplines so that we could really have a broader conversation about innovation. And I hosted Karen on that series, and we really had a great conversation and kind of hit it off. We felt like we were there was a lot of synergy there. We really were thinking about things in really similar ways. She was already working on the book and asked me if I wanted to join in on the effort, and I guess the rest is history.
Getting to know Douglas and his background, I think we both tackle challenges in different ways, and that brought so much life to the ideas and what we're, you know, trying to solve for people, and especially with his facilitation background and really getting tactical and getting beyond the theoretical of, you know, it's hard to launch ideas and here's some actual steps to take. So it led the book to having a lot more depth in the stories, inspiration, the failures, and the activities.
You know, I'll add on one thing there. Like, Karen can be very pragmatic and tactical as well. And it's funny because there are some days where I was being too theoretical. And then, so we really, it was fun to balance each other out and kind of just like maybe hold each other accountable or set the aperture a little lower when we needed to. So it was nice to have a partner in that regard.
So when you're writing this book, what were the problems that you saw that you wanted to solve with this book?
The title kind of gives this away, you know, Start Within. It literally was, you're within an organization, a company, a nonprofit. You might be a teacher in a school district trying to solve a problem in a new way. And it starts within that organization and how to make that idea happen. So that was a big part of how we approach the book, is you're looking around in this organization, you want to push something forward. And then it became philosophical in that a lot of this work starts within yourself. There are things that hold you back and trying to make ideas happen. There are times when you create roadblocks that aren't necessarily really there. And it's the opportunity to both toggle between those. You know, how your idea fits within the organization is really important, but how you fit within both the idea and the organization matters as well. And so Start Within tries to cover all those different components.
What I appreciate about that is, I can't speak for anyone other than myself, but sometimes when we come up against a problem in an organization, we try a little bit to solve it and then we give up and quit and move on to something else when we reach too many roadblocks. And what I appreciate about this is that it's as if you're putting that power into the person's hands to really find the ways to solve it without giving up.
Those roadblocks will typically come up over and over. They'll be the same type, right? My boss wasn't going to let me do this project. Mm-hmm. Later on with a different project, you'll have a different person that gets in your way. And so part of this learning and doing this work and becoming a master at launching ideas within organizations is really not allowing those barriers to be the end all be all, but instead reflect on how you could improve, how it could serve the idea and how it can improve you. And then also, you know, experimenting ways forward.
So as you're writing this book, how do you approach it differently from other books? Because, I mean, there's a lot of business books out there and there's a lot of books about starting projects and launching ideas. So what did you want to do differently?
You know, one thing that was really clear to us from the very beginning was that most innovation books are focused at the C-suite, the executives, the leadership. And, you know, the... Maybe the pathological reason why is because most consultants, most thought leaders are trying to get the attention of those leaders so they can go kind of sell them business. And so they're the direct target. And in fact, in other books that I've worked on, I've gotten a lot of feedback, like what's in it for the executive, the sponsor, the buyer. And we kind of set that stuff aside and really focused on who's doing the work and where are they, what do they need? How can we be best in service of the folks that are in the trenches, on the ground, facing the realities of trying to get this work done? And the interesting thing is like the fact that we've been so focused on creating tools and content directly for them that they can take and be actionable on, that it's actually benefited the leadership, because leadership can now take these tools and hand them into their organizations and really kind of empower things from the bottom up, as well as, you know, lead from the top down.
Yeah, leaders we've found they're very much, you know, we need innovation, we need people to step up and create change, but they've intuited their way forward in their career. It's very hard to teach those skill sets and empower others beyond words, right? And communicating the culture. And so this is that opportunity to teach leaders, managers, people that are trying to bring teams along that, yes, it is hard for those people. Here's why. And here are the places that you can help them get unstuck.
So it sounds like the framework is all encompassing between what leaders can do and what you call the doers can do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the way that we set up Start Within, so each chapter has, you know, the inspiration, the failures, the success, the framework that you can follow. And then it ends with an exercise that you can do alone or with your teams. And it's broken out into three sections, and it's kind of like preparing for a race. I run marathons. So there's the get ready section, there's a get set, and the go. You know, getting ready is all about recognizing that your idea is ready, you yourself, getting yourself and your idea organized. It's about busting assumptions that are going to get in the way of making your idea thrive. And, you know, just aligning and assessing the organization, whether they're ready to take on this idea. So that's all part of the get ready. The get set section is focused on identifying the process you're going to follow. You know, what are the formal and informal written rules within the organization on how to make ideas happen? It's finding alignment to the business objectives and strategies. You know, your idea can't just live off on its own. And it's also getting stakeholder buy-in while you move forward. And then the final section, go, is where you're getting to prototype the idea and you're learning how to turn a no into a yes, and you're building and leading the team to make it happen. And what's been interesting in doing this work that we uncovered is that as a person, when you're kind of moving forward, you typically will excel in one or two of these sections, and that will be where you want to lean in. And then one other section or two sections will feel very uncomfortable. And so it's identifying your strengths. I mean, I'm a go gal. I want to go get started, start experimenting, prototyping. And I have to be disciplined to, you know, do the steps before that, make sure I have stakeholder buy-in. And all of that, you know, being disciplined in it is a muscle. And that was a big, you know, component to all of this. When I looked around as an entrepreneur trying to find the resources, I realized a lot of people believe this is, you know, you're born with this. You're an extrovert. Mm-hmm. You're charismatic. These are the people that I see making the ideas happen. But it doesn't have to be. These are skills you can teach yourself. These are, you know, growth opportunities within yourself. So you can be the person to go push ideas forward.
I love the succinctness of that framework, but I also like that you spoke to the fact that some will be strengths for people and some will be uncomfortable and challenging to work through. And Karen, you already answered this question, but I'm curious, Douglas, what do you struggle with in that framework yourself and what are you drawn to?
You know, I think I typically am like Karen. I want to just get things done. I'm kind of poised for action. Mm-hmm. And I typically struggle when things slow down. or like we have to, there's a natural waiting point, you know? Like I remember when I was, this is not work related, but when we were remodeling my house, you know, there are moments where aside from all the planning, you know, something evolved and happened where, you know, just the confluence of events meant that like we had to take a major break. And I just kind of sat there powerless going, wow, this is 2 weeks of no progress. This is driving me nuts. And also I think a little bit like over the years I've learned the power and the need for planning and organization. So I do it, but I'm much more apt to like, what's something I can just go create right now and learn from. So I'm very, I would say aligned with prototyping and like putting something out there and seeing how it works. As a kid, I used to take stuff apart and put it back together. I'd be more apt to do that than read the instructions.
What I really love about it too, in recognizing our strengths and weaknesses, it's super empowering. Like it will be hard at certain points, and giving yourself permission to suck at one of these means that when it is hard and feels terrible, oh yes, this must be one of those places where I need to learn and grow. It is not impossible. Mm-hmm. It's hard because other parts I'm good at, and this is not one of those moments. And that can unlock and free you to rethink, you know, why it's hard. Rather it being a time that you throw up your hands and say, well, yep, again, too hard for me. It's right. This is where it's uncomfortable. This is where I need to dig in, because it will get easy again when it gets back to a section that I'm more comfortable with. Or when I get to this point again in another idea, mm-hmm. I'll have, you know, strengthened that muscle and become better at it.
You know, Karen, that reminds me of, we talked a lot about, and when we were writing the book, not to position anything that might sound like an opportunity for them to give up or say, yeah, this doesn't work here, or this is too hard, I need to go do this somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So this notion of not playing the victim, and mm-hmm. that goes back and aligns with the start within work, because it's like we need to look inward and think about our strengths, our weaknesses, and how we can improve and how we can be a good leader. Because if I'm not really great at something, then I've got two choices. I can do what I can to be as great as I can with that, or I can find someone that can come follow me and work with me and help do those things that I'm not as good at. And so there's a lot of stuff in the book around, you know, understanding influencers and stakeholders and working with the other people that can help. You know, sometimes it takes a village.
What I hear you say too is that there's a lot of freedom in being open to change, being open to sucking, being open to uncomfortability. And I appreciate that a lot, because sometimes when we're facing those insecurities, instead of avoiding, we can lean into them. We can work within them with others.
Yep.
I'm kind of stuck in my head on that one a little bit, because for me, where I am weak is the get set part, where you're wanting to find the people around that can help you, that can help bring the idea to life, as opposed to being within or taking action. Mm. And it makes sense why I'd be stuck into my head at that point, because getting set revolves around others in a lot of ways. Would you agree?
Yes. And, you know, some people, this is a natural skill that they're born with. They just, mm-hmm. you know, are people network person. They're connected to lots of people. They draw in those people. And then there's the rest of us that have to explore, you know, strengthening those areas. And one thing that we talk about in the book is when you're disciplined, you recognize I need to bring people into this and help push my idea along, not only because I'm going to need help and, you know, resources, but also because it's going to serve the value of the idea. More diversity in thinking and collaborating is going to make the idea in the end even better. So it's not about now it's my idea that I'm leading and finding the right team. It's our idea and we're building it together. And what we talk about in the book is how to go around and finding those people. So, you know, you can look at title, at role or influence. If you're within an organization, there are ways that you can do some research within any of those buckets to find different types of stakeholders. And then once you have that, there's another exercise on how often and how to communicate with them, because not everyone has the same level of interest or even power in making the idea happen. Mm-hmm. And so when you are disciplined about, I have this big group of people that can help me make this idea happen, I need to map them across their interest and power in helping make the idea happen. And then once I have that mapped, I can then step back and be very strategic about how often I'm checking in on the different groups of people. Your boss, as an example, you need to be keeping very close. They have power and interest in your idea. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people that might be really interested, but they're busy. So as you think about making your idea flourish and bringing people into that, I think I like that the idea of being disciplined is an approach, because now there's a way forward. And as mm-hmm. you do that work, you then get better about using your resources, but also about the diversity of who you're bringing at the table.
Yeah, I love this idea of, you know, even thinking about if you're overly optimistic, can you seek out folks that are maybe more pessimistic, in the sense that they're the ones that are always thinking about like what's going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of using game theory to think about like, here are all the things that will break. Whereas that, if that's generally your position, maybe finding someone that's a little more optimistic to balance some of those things out. So when you're doing that get set phase, you can find folks that compliment you. And I think that's in the spirit of, you know, every chapter has an activity. Mm-hmm. And one of the activities is called Nurture the Naysayers. And so rather than just thinking of them as being the people, the guardians, the people that are shutting you down, is like, what can I go learn from them? Because if you're overly optimistic and they're the type that are just always thinking about like, well, this could go wrong, this could go wrong, this could go wrong, that can be really valuable to mm-hmm. to get that perspective. They're shining a flashlight on some cobwebs that you may need to go clean up in your idea.
I love the idea of nurturing the naysayers, and it speaks to a characteristic or mindset of the core of this book, who are the doers, the people who see problems and want to fix them. And that characteristic that kind of pops into my head is they're willing to reach out to naysayers, people who would disagree with them. And that's a very strong characteristic of someone who is confident enough in themselves to be willing to be wrong, or to be shown that they are wrong, or embrace feedback and points of view that's different than them. But what are some other characteristics and mindsets of these doers?
Doers, definitely, they come with different titles across different industries. And an example I like to give is a doer is a person that's walking across the office, you know, in a world where we were working within offices, mm-hmm. and they see this, you know, little bulletin newsletter that fell off the wall, off the cork board. They pick it up and they repin it back up. It has nothing to do with their job to clean up this thing on the floor. The thing that they hung up is not a story or anything that they're related to, but they saw a problem, they just quickly fixed it. They didn't wait for someone else to go do it. Mm-hmm. And doers have that at their core. They notice something that just isn't right, whether that's trying to, you know, improve value for the customer or client, or improve, you know, the culture within the organization. They just are picking up on these issues and aren't waiting for someone else to come in and solve it. They're starting to talk about it with others. And I think we all have this. Mm-hmm. There we get in our own way sometimes, right? And that can be that can be our ego, you know, I'm better than that, so this isn't mm-hmm. something I should be worried about. Or it can be even the like, you know, I don't know how to do it. If someone were to tell me how, now then I would. Those things won't happen. So it's really starting with giving yourself permission to be able to do this work. That's the doer. Like mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be the word innovation or launching ideas. You are just giving yourself the permission to move something forward. And when you have that permission, you now can go out and try to solve for it. I may not know everything I need to know. I may not have everyone lined up behind this idea, but I am a doer that can make that happen.
I'll echo that stuff and add on that I think curiosity is a big, you know, we talked at the beginning about like what we're endlessly curious about. I think that's the hallmark of a good doer, a good product person. They are endlessly curious. They don't seek to be interesting. They're interested in all the things, and they want to mm-hmm. uncover all the problems. They don't come with a ton of ego around their idea. They're willing to be adaptable, and they're resourceful and have tons of grit.
And as a lifelong learner, Douglas, curiosity is one of those things that fuels not only what you do, but it fuels the way that you think, the way that you interact. And that's really interesting to me, because curiosity is as much internal as external.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, how introspective do we get about our ideas and kind of poke at them versus, like, you know, observing the world and what there is to learn. That's fascinating.
What I appreciate about this conversation is that starting within is ultimately about change on so many different levels. It's a conversation of change individually, internally, externally, collectively as our teams, culturally as the company, and then corporately as all of the different hierarchies and levels of power. And that's a lot of change management. I mean, it's one thing to manage your own change, but how can doers prepare themselves, their teams, and the company for change?
I love thinking about the change maker and even breaking those two words apart. Mm-hmm. That change, it's uncomfortable. It's inevitable, mm-hmm. but it's uncomfortable. It's also full of possibility and opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, the maker part of the word, that means doing the work to make it happen. You know, it's not change thinker or change, you know, in theory, it's change making. And I think when you break those two words apart and recognize how you can play a role in both parts, mm-hmm. it just kind of gives you the courage that this is for anybody, that it doesn't have to be the big giant change, that there's small changes I can do right now to get to that point. By doing that, I'm creating a ripple effect within my team, my organization. Or if you do have a big idea, what are the little things that can lead to that bigger idea as well? And I just think right now in this time that we're in, more than ever, you know, complacency has died, right? We're all very hungry to innovate within our jobs. Like, there's a huge need. And if we're looking at that and saying, gosh, someone really needs to solve that, the word change maker, I can own that. I can, you know, accept that there needs to be change, and I can be the one to make it.
I really love how you separated those two words. I mean, that's mind-blowing to me, because on my website, I'm curious in talking with change makers, and I've never heard it said, separate the two words. And wow. And what I would ask is that what leadership is? The ability to be a change space maker?
Totally, right? I mean, at the core of the work that you're doing every single day is, you know, it's not more status quo. Certainly you're trying to find processes to tighten up systems, but even that you're going to want to improve over time. So I think it's, you know, at the core, very much a part of being a leader. And it's also seeing it in others and allowing others to explore it as well. It's not an exclusive mindset for just people that found it. It's for everybody. And how do you help unlock people towards that work?
And I imagine too, Karen, when you worked with IDEO, I mean, they are famous for the creative process of developing products and innovating and creating change. I mean, did that affect how you think about solving problems and being a change maker?
Oh, absolutely. We co-founded the EdTech startup when I was a junior in college, and 13 wow. years later, we were acquired. So I went through many years of maturity and change through that time. And we had created a culture and had mission and vision values, but it wasn't until I got to IDEO that I saw a group that actually lived it mm-hmm. and articulated it in a way that really had meaning. And just it's up on the wall. So lots of companies do that, but it's also in the like heart and soul of what they do. And that was a big part of, you know, growth for me, was looking at those words and being able to say, it's not just about embracing ambiguity. Here's what that looks like. And here's what it doesn't look like, and why, you know, the opposition in that kind of approach doesn't work. And so I learned so much about just putting words around things I believed and then seeing others in action and their approaches and how to do that kind of work.
What are some of your favorite words to put on the wall to test?
I don't know if I put them on the wall per se, but I always just like to challenge like some of the provocative questions are like, what are users actually want? Mm. Or, you know, where might they be struggling? Or, you know, what alternatives? You know, I think jobs to be done is such a fantastic concept, because it helps us start to evaluate not against competitors. Because when we think about who we compete with in the market, it's not necessarily what the user, the person might seek out and use differently. So sometimes we might not feel that we're competing against Excel in the market, but Excel might be our actual competitor when it comes down to them actually trying to get the work done. And so those are the types of things I like to think about when, whether it's, you know, we're helping a company build a better product or even build a better experience for their employees. Like, what are they going to do instead of where have they found a way forward, and really just challenging some of those things, because it's really easy to get caught up into and the what we're doing, and just being able to take a step back and look at like, well, what's the broader kind of environment this stuff is in.
I really like the idea of the provocative question as a driver for almost jumpstarting curiosity. And how do you develop that skill of exploring provocative questions?
I think at first it was about learning about frameworks that exist. And also I've collected a ton of kind of prompt cards. I'm kind of a nerd on this stuff. You know, one of my favorites is Oblique Strategies by Brian Eno. And so then you can kind of riff on them and think, well, this is asking a question that's a little more rooted in relationships, but how can I tweak it to where it's more kind of targeted at users and products or, you know, working with a teammate.
In doing this work tactically, I like to think about, you're reverse engineering something that's maybe in an analogous space. And when you start to, you know, break it down and how they approached either the problem or the product or service that they're solving for, you start to uncover new questions and new ways to approach it that's outside of what was being done or that you were thinking about. So this is part of my go attitude. I like to go and find others that are in a space and doing really hard work, you know, taking on heady challenges, and look at their approaches and then start to break down, how is that different than what I'm doing? And where can I, you know, kind of tweak my approach?
That's powerful. I love the idea of seeking people out and talking to them. Obviously, I'm a bit biased in that statement since, you know, I get to do that in a podcast. But I encourage anyone that I talk to really do that, because it reveals, like you just said, what are they doing? What am I doing? And what can I learn from them?
Yes. Yes. I mean, obviously we can learn from, you know, everybody that we are exposed to, some greater learnings than others. But the biggest thing that holds us back from any lesson is, you know, just going into it with an assumption on what value you're going to get out of that conversation or from that person. And instead just going in with an open mind and a beginner's mindset that, you know, everything will have a value at some point, and it's, you know, just trying to soak it all in.
That's something through the years I've found really helpful in my career, is just tons of networking, and not in the sense of like, oh, I'm out at the you know, meet and greet, just handing out business cards, but, you know, trying to find interesting people where there can be a really meaningful conversation. And, you know, sometimes the person I'm meeting with benefits more than I do, and there's a give and take, right? But one of the things that's maybe not as obvious, of course, there's the serendipity of just like random things that surface that you don't even expect before you, when you're scheduling it. But the thing that I think is really non-obvious is the moments when you're talking about the work you're doing or just sharing things out, when you say it in a way that was unexpected, or as you're describing it to them, you go off on a slightly different tangent than you have before. I found those moments to be really helpful, you know, and I always bring my notebook with me, because sometimes I'll say something to the person I'm having coffee with and it'll just light a light bulb off, and I quickly scribble it down because I want to make sure I don't lose it and I come back to it. So it's something about, you know, talking to other folks, and it's the same reason when you're, you know, practicing for a presentation, you want to do it in front of a live audience if you can, you know, even if it's just your dog. So it's something about that connection that happens where some real creative stuff can start flowing.
So as go-getters, people who are devoted to taking action, I bet the section on prototypes was very powerful to you. And one of the phrases that I just clued into and loved was a prototype is worth 1,000 meetings, which is a great statement. But as you go into the process of developing prototypes, how do you get past that allure of perfectionism that can sometimes get in the way of just getting something that sucks aesthetically but solves the problem?
You know, I think that time boxing is huge for that. And that's one of the big benefits of design sprints. And you certainly don't have to do a full design sprint to benefit from this concept. It's just set a deadline, make it aggressive, and say that we're gonna build this thing in a short amount of time, and it will be what it is. Also, I think where a lot of people get flawed is, well, there's a few things. One is the definition. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking of prototypes as proof of concepts, then you're going to overbuild it. Mm-hmm. Instead, think of a prototype as a tool to answer a question, and get really specific about the question you're trying to answer. Even then, you know, sometimes folks will have too many questions, and it's important to prioritize the ones that are the most critical. And so we talk about, you know, you want to go after things that are high risk. If it turns out you're wrong, what's going to have the most damage to your project or might completely kill it, then we want to learn those things quickly. So we'll prioritize those things. And then also, you know, we can look at like how easy it is to prototype. If we can answer risky assumptions quickly, then we want to prioritize those things, because those learnings might, you know, obviate some of the other questions that we might have. We might decide to pivot in a way that those things don't become relevant anymore. So perfection is the enemy of good, and certainly is the enemy of learning. And so if we can steer that mindset, that's going to benefit us quite greatly.
Yeah. And even thinking about, you know, I have a 4-year-old and he is developing and mastering his communication skills. And, you know, when he makes a mistake and uses a past tense incorrectly or whatever, I don't, you know, laugh or point at him and tell him he's an idiot, right? I, you know, very gently nudge him in the right direction and then we move on. Mm-hmm. And there's something about perfectionism that when we're kids, it's not something we're as focused on. And then it gets beat out of us. Like, we want to be smart enough. We want to be good enough. We want to have answered these questions, and we don't want to raise our hands and speak out of turn and look foolish. So if we accept that there's something in our upbringing that changed that in ourselves, but that really and truly, you know, perfection is shutting the door for others to help bring it along, right? It's, if the idea is completely perfect in your head and you're not open to, you know, learning from it, then others aren't going to be open to providing feedback that is very much necessary in making the idea better. So it's, you know, letting go that this is something, and as humans, that we've been, you know, it came with us as we grew up, recognizing that a lot of it is around ego, and teaching yourself to, you know, allow for those imperfections to show. I mean, Douglas and I, we struggle with this often. We're prototyping the book early on, right? We had our test readers read it before we had a copy editor. And, you know, some of our test readers had some grammar and other, you know, things that they found. And of course, yeah, we needed to go fix those. If we had waited until those were perfect, then we wouldn't have gotten the early feedback to be able to continue to shape the book. The ego often gets in the way, and it's, you know, teaching yourself on how to let it go.
How did you teach yourself to let go of the ego and embrace that feedback? Because that can be oftentimes what a lot of creative entrepreneurs struggle with, is not putting yourself in those positions to get that valuable word that you need.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's something in me personally that mm-hmm. it makes it easier than others. Like, I really and truly have said weird things and sounded strange in a meeting and been okay with it. And then other times I lay in bed, I'm like, why did I ask that question? Of course I knew the answer. But in hindsight, and talking about this with people I've worked with, leadership, and then, you know, colleagues as well, they've, you know, mentioned that this is a superpower. This is something that I'm, you know, that they don't see it as Karen is, you know, says strange things that are just off the top of her head. They think they see it as thoughtful and the right questions and things that we should be, you know, taking advantage of. So I think there's been some, in my career, opportunities that it's been supported, right? Like, I wasn't laughed at, but truly, when you do this kind of work, there'll be moments where you feel like you're getting laughed at. Is that the worst? Is that the, you know, the most painful failure? No, because you learn from it and you can move on. I would, that feels better than not getting laughed at, than not putting it out there and not seeing it come together. And then later on, kind of kicking myself and saying, oh, I wish I'd asked that question because it would have really helped set things straight early on.
You know, you asked where I learned this and or where we learned this. And I immediately thought about the school of hard knocks. It's like I've been in a lot of startups that didn't make it. And it taught me that the good ideas aren't always the thing that survives, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I think maybe one of my early lessons there was, you know, just even products that I felt were far superior, but just maybe weren't marketed as well or weren't well positioned somehow, like manage, you know, the beta, what was it, the Betamax and the VCR, or like, yep. You know, there's lots of examples out there that I really keyed into early on. And I would say also, as a musician, maybe just by happenstance or by my nature, how I was brought up, I gravitated toward bands where it was communal in our writing mm-hmm. styles. So we would come together and maybe someone would have a kernel of an idea and they would throw it out there and we'd all work together on it. So no one really felt, the band wrote the song, not Douglas. And then they like arranged it or whatever. When I moved to Austin, it was really, really bizarre because there's definitely a singer-songwriter ethos in Austin. So like every musician that I was trying to start bands with, they had this, they would bring in the songs. It's like, okay, write your parts of this. This is the song that I wrote. And it felt so foreign and weird to me. And so, you know, I can't help but think about how, you know, that was pretty formative in my style of creativity.
That's actually really mind-blowing to me because as you're describing that ethos, I think about the bands that I were attracted to growing up, and it's like Metallica was the band for me, and that was almost a dictatorship in terms of how they came up with ideas initially, and they would in a sense evolve into that collective nature. But it's fascinating that perhaps that could be part of why I struggle with feedback and wanting to have almost that dictatorship of ideas at times. That, okay, that's mind blowing to me.
You know, you could certainly blame it all on the Metallica.
And exactly.
If you're a Metallica fan, I definitely suggest checking out the documentary Saint Anger, which is like, it is nuts. They even dropped it doesn't make them look very good, which is like interesting because they produced it. Mm-hmm. And they even paid for a helicopter scene. So it is like, it's pretty phenomenal. I highly encourage people to check it out.
Absolutely. As a documentarian, I often run into people that love music and we'll talk about that for ages. So don't need to go on that tangent right now, but I'm just that, Douglas, that's such a mind-blowing thought. And I love that. I'm going to be reflecting on that. But one of the things that I'm curious about is that, and I'm really appreciative of with this book, is that is equally actionable and valuable for companies of one or much larger organizations. So speaking to an audience of creative entrepreneurs who are most likely working by themselves or with a small crew, what would you recommend they focus on first in applying Start Within in their business?
The idea of starting within, as I shared earlier, it's, you know, within the organization, the structure, the environment that you work, it's also within, you know, starting within yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an opportunity to just pause and reflect on what holds you back in doing mm-hmm. this kind of work. Like, you know, what are the things that get in your way? You know, I don't have the right skills, or my colleagues wouldn't want to do this work, or whatever. And writing those down, just giving yourself the time and space to think about the negativity, the stuff that you know, like put it all out there. And then with that in hand, reflect on what's truly holding you back and what's you holding yourself back. And, you know, if you think about starting a new workout program or, you know, trying to eat, you know, a healthier diet, it usually when you write down your excuses, you know, I need new shoes, I need, you know, to find the time. Well, all of those you can counterattack with strategies, right? You can get up earlier, you can whatever. And that's true for trying to make new ideas happen. And even if there are little small steps to get there and changes to make the work happen, typically it starts with yourself and figuring out a way around. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that small exercise, that's kind of your moment of truth. This is where you can grow, and this is how you can move forward from it.
You know, there are some things that are more applicable to larger organizations, you know, whether it's like assessing your organizational readiness or thinking about what's the process here. You know, small groups, entrepreneurs with really small teams, you know, the process is fluid. It's probably changing daily, and changing the process is like very easy, right? So that some of those things aren't as applicable. Now, I would say that the two that jump out to me that are, you know, just you absolutely cannot live without are prototypes and the assumption work. Everyone suffers from those. That is across the board something that requires focus and dedication. And if you're not creating prototypes, you should be. And, you know, creating a painted door test, like lean startup style, is not prototyping. So I encourage folks to, you know, what are the cheap and easy ways to test your questions? And one of my favorite examples of a prototype is a 5-pound weight. Mm. We had a client that was considering this new piece of electronic equipment they were building for scientists out in the field. And when they got all the specifications in, the engineer said, you know, we could repurpose some stuff we've already built, some modules we've already got. We think we could get this out the door pretty quickly, but early designs are showing that it's going to be about 5 pounds. And so they went and shared these insights and these plans with the client, and the client checked off on all of them. There's this one product manager that didn't sit very well with, and she said to herself, you know, do they have the, you know, these clients, these users actually know what it's going to be like to use this 5-pound piece of equipment? And so she went out into the field and met with the scientist and gave them a 5-pound weight that she had dug out of her closet and asked them to hold it up in the air because they were measuring stuff in the canopy of trees. So they had to hold it up and then pull it down and take a measurement and then hold it back up. So they're basically doing a shoulder press like all day, essentially. And it didn't take very long for them to say, yeah, maybe this is a little heavy. You know, and so they redesigned it with a really lightweight wand with a sensor on it. And the reading could be held down at their waist or clipped onto something. That's what my point around proof of concept versus prototype. As long as it's answering a question that you desperately need to answer, then that's the you know, that's the hallmark of a great prototype. And so my advice to small teams, if you're not doing that, you need to start now.
What a great illustration too of the power of getting out from behind the computer, out of your workspace, and into where you're going to actually wrestle with that question. Well, Douglas and Karen, this has been such a fun conversation. I just have one last question for you both. What book, podcast, or resource is currently blowing your mind?
This year has been my year of leaning in on female-written books.
Nice.
You know, both fiction and business. Mm-hmm. So some that really stand out on the fiction side. I just finished reading Such a Fun Age. It was such great writing by Kylie Reed. And then, you know, just most recently in the two kind of business type books. One is Uncanny Valley, which is a memoir of a woman that had worked in the Silicon Valley, kind of a coming of age meets, you know, reckoning and where we're at with technology right now. And it's such great writing and so interesting if you're in the tech space. And then beyond that, most recently finished No Filter, the Sarah Friar book on Instagram and, you know, both the inception and then the move into Facebook and how, you know, that changed things, right? They're not a startup anymore. They're now within this, you know, larger organization. So very much drawn to that. And those books were all page turners. So good.
It's somewhat controversial and definitely a mark of our times and where we're at right now. But I recently finished White Fragility and specifically enjoyed the reading guide. There are some really amazing prompts in that guide. D'Angelo refers to them as silence breakers. And the whole concept of a silence breaker is so phenomenal to me. And we've actually been using them with the team and with other and designing them into meetings and things that where we see appropriate. And so anyone who's read that book or curious about it, definitely go download the reading guide. It's really, really helpful and phenomenal. And on a more, with maybe a little more levity, I would say the Space Force has been blowing my mind as well.
Oh, that's great. Well, Karen and Douglas, thank you both for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Thank you for this therapy session. Where do I send the bill?
Yeah, exactly. It was so fun. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you both. It's been a pleasure to dive into your book and just to have a great conversation about, you know, get ready, get set, and go. Thank you both.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
I absolutely love this conversation with Karen and Douglas, and I hope you did too. Whether you work for yourself or for a company, it's important that you understand that making new ideas happen and solving problems starts with you. In the day-to-day work we do, it can be really easy to forget that. I know I do at times. So I want to ask you, what new idea are you sitting on that could use a little bit of action on? I encourage you to become a doer as you get ready, get set, and go. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.